Okay, well, thank you, Martin. And I guess first off, I just would like to say thank you to the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine for inviting me to speak. And thank you in particular to Martin and Virginia Berridge, who couldn't make it today, for their kind invitation and your warm hospitality. And I'd like to thank you all for coming as well. I realise that this topic might seem kind of obscure and specific, but I hope to kind of show that I think this is a vital turning point in the evolution of the international drug control system. And it really has long-term implications, and right up to the present day, for how we understand what is legitimate drug use. So with that said, I'll begin. So my paper looks at the resolution of what we might call the colonial issue. And this is essentially the question of how to deal with the existence of colonial opium monopolies in the Far East. At the outbreak of World War II, you see France, Britain, Holland, Portugal all have colonial opium monopolies, and this is a major point of contention for the international system at the outbreak of war. And as I was saying, I think this is really a vital turning point. The resolution of this issue in 1943 to 45 really represents a major turning point in the evolution of the international drug control system. So in the 1930s, I think what you see is the system is largely deadlocked. They can't figure out how to resolve this issue, and it's mainly around this fact that they can't figure out a solution to this problem and they can't find a way forward. So when they actually resolve this issue, you see the deadlock of the interwar years, the potential is that they can resolve it. So I think one way to think about it is, on one side of the international control system from the very start, you have the kind of strict supply control advocates, and these are led by the United States, China, some other kind of minor players. Predominantly it's a US-led initiative. And the idea is you have to restrict the supply of narcotics. If you want to control international drug problems, you focus on restricting supply. And the only way to do that is to limit all global production to only medical and scientific needs. There is no other legitimate production. Anything else is just going to leak off into an illicit market. On the other side, you have producer countries. A lot of colonial nations that basically, opium is very heavily intertwined with their domestic economy, their social fabric. There's not very strong central governments, so there's no real way to eradicate this problem. And in the middle, you have the colonial powers, acting as a kind of buffer between these two extremes. And you have Britain, France, all these countries which, on one end, are trying to placate the Americans and do kind of take a more a kind of normative view of this, that yes, the correct thing to do is to eradicate opium, but we also understand the logistics involved in trying to do that and the severe difficulties of trying to do that. And so I think that's why you see, if you take a kind of political science view of it, you've got these two cleavages, but in the middle, you've got the old colonial powers, and they're stopping the resolution of this. So I think what I'll try to argue is that because this issue was resolved, you actually see the system then solidifies into a post-war paradigm where it's strictly manufacturers versus producers. And it's basically the friction between those two different camps which leads to the kind of international control system that I think Dave was talking about a couple of weeks ago that becomes solidified in the single convention. So, some background history of the system. I'm sorry if I'm repeating Dave, but I hope to give it a slightly different slant. Okay, so I think my focus is Anglo-American relations, so I'm going to divide it into two. We're going to look at the American perspective and we're going to look at the British perspective and how the two meshed, because they were actually quite opposing. The American paradigm for international drug control really solidified around the turn of the 20th century. And I think there were really three core features. There was this kind of progressivism that you see was a general trend in the United States at the turn of the 20th century. And this sense of we can use government to fix large-scale social problems. And this gained an international footing under the administration of Teddy Roosevelt. You had certain international missionaries and you had certain just basically internationally minded people who took an interest in this issue, and they convinced the president to kind of push this at the international level. I think it's complicated because I have been asked, is this progressivism linked to the kind of same progressivism that led to alcohol prohibition in the United States? And I think that's a very complicated question and something I haven't certainly figured out in my mind. So if anyone here is a particular expert on this time period, I'd certainly love to hear what you think. There was also, I think, an important point in the United States is this changing perception of drug users. Post-Civil War and right up to the turn of the 20th century, the perception is opiate users are elderly women or, soldiers or, middle-aged women for all sorts of illnesses. It wasn't really until it became associated with these kind of immigrant laborers. Like, as Chinese laborers start to come into the West Coast, opium smoking becomes associated with them, and it becomes something that's foreign and almost invading. And then as you move into the 20th century, it becomes more associated with, you know, foreigners, young people, and more socially marginal groups. And that's when you see this kind of a very kind of unified sense that drug use is evil, it's immoral, and it's foreign, and it needs to be extinguished. Now, this is the part I think is most is the greatest explanation for why the US tried to internationalize this issue. It was largely centered around China. So what you see, as I was saying, with as opium smoking starts to become an issue on the West Coast, you see the first anti-opium laws. And really, there's a lot of reason to think that these were just purely racist. It was they didn't like foreigners, and this is a way to attack foreigners. And then this escalates into actual anti-immigration laws, I think. And so this alienates a lot of the Chinese business constituency within the United States, and it drives a big wedge. The problem is this is at the same time as the US is moving to close its frontier and basically move over into overseas markets. And so what you see in 1895 and beyond, as the US closes its frontier, is it says, it makes explicit to the European powers that we are not going to see China divided up. We want to see a single market, we want to see a coherent government, something that we can trade with. We're not going to let you do the same thing you did in Africa. So these two things kind of mesh. On the one side, there is the perception that opium is one of the main causes of the disintegration that's happening in China at the time. I think the historiography hasn't answered this question. I don't think we know whether opium was a symptom or a cause of the decay, but it was certainly the perception was that opium was causing the decay. So the US thought that by tackling the opium problem, we forestall the decay of China, which means that it remains a centralized state, which means that we can trade with it. There's also then undoing the kind of damage that this this immigration issue had done. It was a way for them to just curry favor with the Chinese. Like, it's very difficult to overstate how central a position opium has in the Chinese psyche around this time. It's a symbol of national disgrace. And by the US kind of siding themselves as anti-opium, they're putting themselves on the side of the Chinese. So these two all kind of mesh very well together, and they fit with this kind of post 1895 US becoming more involved in international affairs. And then this again, as the US moves into overseas, you see the Spanish-American War, and they take over the Philippines. And when they take over the Philippines, they inherit opium monopolies. And the question is, what do we do with these? Well, we've been saying opium's immoral, so eventually there's no choice but to just completely eradicate it. So they have all these options. Do we take over the monopolies? Do we reinstitute them temporarily? Do we shut them down immediately? And they basically take the view that any non-medical, non-scientific use of opium is immoral, and that's the model we're going to take. And this is essentially the model that they think should be internationalized. You know, there's a tendency within American policymakers to see what was in their own interest as kind of just naturally the moral thing to do. And so the whole international system would have to kind of evolve to fit this model. So one of the reasons why they want to internationalize it is, well, they know full well that you can't prohibit opium in one area if it's being freely traded in other areas. So the only way to stop opium flowing into the Philippines is to prohibit it all over the world. And this is one of the big pushes to internationalize this thing. Now, the British paradigm is, I think, far more complicated. I think it is actually fair to say far more nuanced. Britain had a much longer history in this issue. And they understood the complexities involved. They get a lot of bad press about, you know, basically opium is seen as a means to subjugate foreign peoples and profit from them, and it's you know, an immoral trade. And there is an extent, I think, that is true. But there was also a realization that we don't have control over these areas to the extent that prohibition would require. So we can't just decide, well, we find opium immoral and we're going to just go in and completely eradicate it. I don't think they thought that was a feasible option. And I think that view informs a lot of how they react to the American kind of pressure. So there's really multiple competing policy strands. There were the same anti-opium goals within Britain around this time. You do have these internationalist missionary constituencies that are saying, this is immoral, this is wrong, we need to end this trade. And they did have some power within Parliament. But you also see the colonial interests, which clearly for Britain at this time, certainly around the 20th to the turn of the century, are more important than a minor domestic constituency. It's how do we administer these colonies effectively, cheaply, with minimal social strife. And this is very quickly reflected actually even within Whitehall. In 1924-25, you see a big blow-up. The Home Office and the Foreign Office had come to the view that, yes, we should just completely eradicate the opium monopolies. We'll limit only to medical and scientific needs. The Home Office was slightly more ideological. There was just one man in it in particular who was pushing it. Virginia Berridge has written a lot about him, Malcolm Delevingne. The Foreign Office was more just this is something that's interfering with broader foreign policy concerns, and we should probably just do away with it. The Colonial Office are the ones who would have to actually enforce it, and they're the ones who are vehemently saying, absolutely not, this is not a feasible policy, this sounds good in practice, but it, or on paper, but it will never work, we don't have control over so many of these areas. And so you see actually a full-on bureaucratic dogfight, 1924-1925, where it reaches all the way to cabinet level, and it's not even clear how it's going to be decided. It could have very easily gone the Home Office, Foreign Office way. In the end, the Colonial Office wins out. But there is a sense that there is a progression in British policy towards, well, we're trying to get to the Home Office, Foreign Office view, but we just don't know how to do it quite yet. There's also these kind of internationalist goals, and I think there's a lot of resonance, if we think about it in the current days, where people are or when the US talks about getting China to buy into the international security framework. I think we're seeing a mirror image happen around this time, where Britain is trying to get America to buy into the international security framework. So post-World War I, America's gone back into isolationism largely, and essentially Britain is trying to get it to cooperate with the League of Nations. And opium is probably, I think, the only area where it really consistently, although very complicatedly, cooperates with the League of Nations. So Britain kind of sees this as a means to an end. If America is willing to cooperate on opium issues with the League of Nations, and there's bureaucrats within the League of Nations independent of Britain as well pushing this, they see this as a way to kind of get the Americans to come on side. So for Britain, this is a means to an end. If we go along with the opium issue, we get America into an end of greater cooperation internationally, which means that we have to spend less on security. For the Americans, this is an end in itself. So they didn't have an interest in the broader League of Nations, but they did in this issue. And there's also, just to keep in mind, India as a kind of perennial thorn in the side of the US. India was one state at the old League of Nations Opium Advisory Committee that would almost come to blows with the US delegations if need be. They didn't mind saying no. They would consistently, if something wasn't in their interest, they would just happily say, we are not interested, we are not going to pursue this policy. And the foreign, even the Home Office had a very difficult time with them, because the India Office were very, very just willing to put their own interests first. So the battle lines for the international system, I think, in the kind of pre-war and interwar years, really begin with the Hague Conference. Well, really 1909, because there's the Opium Commission in 1909, but I don't mean to be complicating the narrative, but really the first international control system, the first treaty of the international control system is the 1912 Hague Conference. And this is essentially a normative treaty. It sets the basis for the international system, or what Dave would call the regime. And it essentially says we want to work towards eradicating drug abuse. It doesn't exactly say what drug abuse is, because that's a controversial term. And it doesn't exactly say how they're going to do it. They just say this is our goal. We as nation states want to eradicate drug abuse. And so what you see emerge is this kind of division of definitions. And this is what the whole battle becomes over, is control advocates say strict medical scientific only, something that we in Western societies would recognise as a medical scientific approach. You go to a doctor, you get a prescription if you need a narcotic. Colonial states, on the other hand, are saying, well, that's all well and good, but we're administering areas without even basic medical services. So that's not even remotely feasible. And you've got the foothills of Burma, where there is no centralised government control, and people have for centuries been using opium as medicinal, as recreational, and it's deeply ingrained within their societies. So what they call it is quasi-medical. They say this is medical. It's not fully medical what we'd understand, but it's a quasi-medical use, and it's not something that can be eradicated. And so the real battle lines from 1909 right through to 1943-45, and even beyond, but to a less extent, is the battle to move from quasi-medical use to medical and scientific only. And this is really the core of the colonial issue, I think. So around 1939, at the outbreak of war, what we see is Britain has, as I was saying, there is this progression within British policy, and there is this attempt to move in that direction. You know, 1932, Burma, a place with absolutely no ability to actually enforce the policy, says we're going to eradicate all use of opium, all non-medical scientific use, including opium eating, opium smoking. The two big ones are opium smoking, which is seen as recreational, and nobody really argues that that has any medical usage. Opium eating, however, is very, very useful. It's seen as a prophylactic against malaria, it's a painkiller, it's, you know, the coolie class in Burma, who have probably one of the worst jobs in the world that you could imagine, they use this to keep them alive, basically. But nevertheless, Britain is kind of experimenting with these regulations about, well, how do we move towards eradication? And they said, you know, the monopolies are one way to deal with that. It's we set up a system where people get certificates if they are addicts, and we give it to no more people. So we have an existing addict population which we service, and we try let them kind of die out almost, is kind of the view. But consistently, they're rejecting American calls for prohibition of smoking and monopolies. So in 1936, you see a big conference. It's one of the major international conferences on narcotics control. And the Americans try to walk out, because they go in and they say, we want everyone to prohibit opium smoking and move to strict medical scientific use only. Everyone says no, and the Americans try to walk out. They don't in the end, but it leads to a big bust-up. And so post-1936, it's not altogether clear that the regime can kind of hold together, because there's just too many kind of diverging interests. The US see anything less, they're not willing to compromise this. They see it as a moral issue, and they won't accept anything other than their own views. Britain's main thing, and this is something that we'll see now in World War II, is they cite China as the main logistical problem. And it's a very fair point to make. China is completely descending into anarchy. You've got 1920s, 1930s, you've got warlordism, people are trading opium to buy arms, to kill each other, and then, you know, soldiers who are ill or soldiers who are injured use opium to manage the pain, all these kind of things. And China is in no way able to suppress the opium problem. So when Britain's territories are all bordering China, it's very difficult to try to suppress your own internal domestic market when you've got an enormous black market on your doorstep. And this is especially true for Burma. So even if Britain pushed opium production fully out of Burma, it would just come into China, and then they'd be dealing with smugglers and all the social unrest that ensues. And you see it in Hong Kong as another example, where the main policy becomes they try to suppress, but it just drives people into the black market. So the main policy becomes we have to coerce addicts into buying government opium. We're not even trying to suppress opium, we're just trying to suppress the black market relative to our own government sources. So I think the regime in 1939, as I was saying, after the conference in 1936, it's kind of this mixture of contradictions, half measures. It doesn't really know what it's aiming to do, and there's just too many competing interests. It's very kind of a multipolar regime. Nobody's able to take the lead. And so, like, when you even look at the contradictions, London is at these international conferences condemning saying that we're trying to move the world towards non-medical use or only medical use of opium, yet its colonies are basically providing it to citizens under a monopoly system and profiting from it. As I was saying, the core kind of cleavage is this kind of producers on one side versus manufacturers on the other. So people who are, you've got these emergent pharmaceutical sectors in developed countries, and you've got producer countries that are growing opium. And the two economies are dependent on each sector, and so neither wants to see their own sector damaged. But so manufacturers, it's all about trying to shift the regulatory burden onto producers. It's manufacturers are happy if there's very little production that they can buy and manufacture into a drug. And so it's really the battle between these two about who actually bears the regulatory burden of supply control. By this stage, supply control was the idea behind the system. That had been accepted. There was a bureaucracy that had grown up, and it just kind of internalized this notion of supply control, and nobody was really questioning it by the outbreak of war. But as I was saying, there was other cleavages. So under manufacturers, you had the supply control advocates, of whom the US is the main example. But again, you have these colonial powers in the middle, and they're really acting as the buffer. So they're stopping this kind of major resolution of this issue. So this is really the meat of what my research is on, is the World War II era and how this issue gets resolved. So what we see in the outbreak of World War II is this. Initially, the regime tries to keep going. It says, well, we're independent of all the fighting. Even a lot of belligerent states, like even Hitler, was quietly cooperating with it because it was seen as having some utility, kind of utilitarian value. And so they just tried to stay above it all. As Hitler took over most of continental Europe, and these guys were based in Geneva, some of them were Jewish, it got very, very complicated. So they managed to arrange a shift of what's called the Permanent Central Opium Board and the Drug Supervisory Body. Has anyone heard of these bodies before? Has anyone heard of the International Narcotics Control Board? Okay, well, the INCB is the latest that actually exists still today. These two were merged into that in the 1960s. But these are basically quasi-judicial, these are they're independent of the League of Nations, and they're basically administrative bodies at the international level. And they monitor the international flow of narcotics. and their job is to make sure that there's no excesses building up anywhere, and that there's no country is importing more than it should and then re-exporting it to other countries. And so the US is happy to cooperate with these guys. It hates the League of Nations framework. It hates the kind of, they see the Opium Advisory Committee and the League of Nations as becoming as being politicized, full of the old colonial powers. It can happily rot in Geneva. But they're willing to let, that's a phrase Bill McAllister uses, by the way, I should probably say that. They want to see these guys salvaged. And so they basically say, you can hide out in Washington for the remainder of the war, just don't do anything political, don't cause any problems for us. And what you see happen is basically this inner circle emerges while these guys are based in Washington, of all these supply control advocates in one place at one time with a lot of control. So this guy, Harry Anslinger, has anyone heard of him? Basically the most important man of international drug control of the 20th century, I think. He ran US drug policy for 40 years. He was an extraordinary, brilliant bureaucrat. He was basically, think of J. Edgar Hoover with less power and a smaller agency. So he was somebody who was very, he wanted to see the supply control issue or the colonial issue resolved, and he saw that the fact he was pretty unscrupulous. He thought the ends justified the means, and so he basically decided, I'm going to use this time while these guys are in Washington to influence them and try recreate the system for the post-war world. And he had the brains to do it. He had the kind of vision, he had the brains. Whether he was right, that's another issue, but... So this is what Bill McAllister calls the inner circle starts to emerge while they're in Washington. So what you also see actually going on at the same time is in London, there's people, DSB and PCOB staff, who are stranded here during the war. And they have no contact really with what's going on in Washington, or not a great extent. So they start to feel left out. They start to feel like, well, this is a bureaucratic flanking maneuver. Come the post-war, we might be out of a job. So they start to cooperate with the Home Office and the Foreign Office. The Foreign Office is very close to Washington during the war. This is the, you know, the high time of the special relationship, or at least the Grand Alliance. And so the Foreign Office is able to provide these guys access. On the other hand, as Anslinger starts to push this issue with the British and starts to make an issue of it in 1942, the Foreign Office haven't a clue what's going on. It's not even on their radar around this time. And they don't know why the Americans have got such a bee in their bonnet about it, but the Americans really do. There's this very strong domestic constituency there about it. So they're using these guys then, saying, as kind of consultants and advisors, and you see this kind of very close relationship emerge between the two, what I call the London Four. If anyone can tell me a better name, I just haven't thought of one. So America joins the war after Pearl Harbor, and you see this kind of, the League apparatus starts to jump back into gear and saying, well, okay, it looks like the Allies could win. What happens post-war if they win? We better start looking at this because we want to salvage this and we don't want the whole League apparatus to fall apart. So the kind of political side of the League apparatus meets in London in 1942, and they start discussing, well, what's post-war planning? Let's get ahead of the curve on this. But it's largely a kind of bureaucratic continuity meeting. It's very clear that all they're trying to do is save their jobs. And so they start saying, well, there's immediate logistical concerns that come after the war. And that's true. You go into war-torn areas, you could have massive stockpiles of morphine stolen and sold onto the black market. You could have people, just enormous addict populations suddenly kick off. So how do we control drugs in these areas? This is what they focus on. And they basically avoid it. Broader political issues. They say, we're not going to talk about the conventions, we're not going to talk about all the nastiness that happened pre-war, we're just going to focus on immediate logistical concerns and show that we're actually a useful bureaucracy. And they avoided the colonial issue. They discussed it and they said, yeah, this is still complicated, we don't quite know how to deal with it, and anyway, prohibition is not going to bring about the expected result. So let's put this off to post-war and let's have a broader think about it. Well, the Anslinger and the Inner Circle in Washington expected so much, and when they saw the outcome of this meeting, they said, this is the old political runabout, we're going to outmaneuver them, we're going to get ahead of the curve of these guys on this issue, and we're going to push this, and we're going to try recreate our own system post-war with the parts that we like. And so he really kind of seized on the leverage that the US had at this time. It was time-constrained, I think, they recognized that. US had a lot of control at this time. They had this leverage and they were going to use it. So he comes up with this strategy, and it's quite a bold and it's quite a brilliant strategy. He starts lying. He starts saying, well, there's a huge amount of resolve in the US government on this, and you know, the press are sniffing around about this, and we've decided that we just, you know, if US soldiers go into the Far East, there is no way we're going to allow colonial opium monopolies to be reinstituted. It's just not going to happen. We don't want to see our soldiers become infected with this disease of addiction and then bring it back home. And it's immoral, and we're not fighting this war, by the way, to give you back these kind of immoral industries. And the reality was, you know, 1942 started in 1943, the US is only getting its footing in the war. It's a junior partner compared to Britain, certainly in 1942. By 1943, they're just reaching parity. And this is not even on the radar. This, you know, they're not even winning the war at this time. So nobody's thinking about kind of, well, what are the specifics of our post-war occupation policies? But even in that regard, they had no right to dictate. There was a joint forces agreement with Britain, where basically it's not up to them. The Americans can't go into one of these territories and unilaterally end these monopolies or institute any policies. It's something that the civilian authorities have to decide. So he's essentially lying. And the State Department sat in on meetings he had with the British and just sat quietly, said nothing, as this guy was bluffing. And it, potentially it could have been quite an embarrassing climb down for the US. Also, late 1942, they invade North Africa and France reinstitutes a hashish monopoly. And all the Americans could do was tell their troops not to go in there. So there was even a precedent where they had actually reinstituted a monopoly very early on. But when this issue starts to come up in London, there's a lot of complications, and they start to get quite worried about it. The embassy in Washington at the time, when they get invited to this meeting, went into a complete panic. They're like, what in God's name is going on here? We don't understand this issue at all. They start sending these letters saying, well, we just sent an observer. We didn't realize we were stepping into this kind of this cauldron of old interests. So, and what you see very quickly emerge is the kind of Home Office, Foreign Office, Colonial Office divide just immediately reemerges. You have the Home Office and the Foreign Office saying, well, this has broader issues. This impacts our foreign policies. This is, you know, this is our closest ally. Do we really want to be arguing with them over this? The Colonial Office says, well, look, this is not, we've been through this. This is not a feasible policy option. But the context has completely changed. So the power relationship, at least in Whitehall, has completely changed. So 1920s, the Colonial Office is arguably the more powerful relatively, it's more powerful than it certainly was in World War II. Around World War II, it's arguing about colonies that it didn't control, about administrative benefits that they didn't feel, whereas the Foreign Office is now the kind of gatekeeper to the Transatlantic Alliance, the most important foreign policy issue to Britain during World War II. I think it's the Foreign Office is going to win in any kind of battle in this regard. Both sides continue to blame China. And it's ironic, well, it's not ironic, but the US are sitting in these meetings with the British saying, well, the Chinese are so adamant about this and they're working so hard, and Chiang has enforced complete prohibition in China of opium. It's only in the areas under Japanese control that you see opium still exists. And this is completely untrue. The Chiang was anti-opium, but his government didn't have the control over the areas to kind of stamp it out. A lot of his own generals were trading in opium. And so the British said, well, this is not true. The reasons why we can't do this is specifically because of China. We want to prohibit opium in Burma, but we can't because of China. And so the Foreign Office actually go far and say, this is the work of foreign and Chinese propagandists. And I can only assume the foreign means actually the US. But they got very, very antsy about it. Nevertheless, they decide that they're going to go along with this. And it's quite early on that they decide, well, we have to accommodate this as far as possible. So what you see is in November 1943... both Britain and Holland agree a kind of mutual announcement. France obviously isn't in control of these territories at the time, and so doesn't make an announcement, but they do in 1945. And basically the two agree, we're going to announce at the same time and we're going to try and get a big publicity coup out of this. So what they say is in the House of Commons, I think it's the colonial secretary stands up and says, we're going to prohibit opium smoking, and we're going to end prepared opium monopolies in Far Eastern territories, then under Japanese occupation. But it is, by the way, dependent upon success of prohibition in surrounding areas. So it's remarkable when you first read, I have it kind of done out here with underlines, but when you read it through, it sounds very blanket and very broad. And so if the Americans read it, they would have gotten very excited and like, wow, we've won, basically. But there's a lot of ifs kind of written into this. Prepared opium monopolies. Well, that doesn't cover monopolies that sell to people who eat opium. Prepared opium is only smoking opium. So they can continue to sell opium to people in India, and even it becomes a big issue in Burma where they're going to continue this practice. In Far Eastern territories, then under Japanese occupation, well, India's not under Japanese occupation. Parts of Burma aren't under Japanese occupation. So it's not a blanket ban across all of the empire. They also say, this is what they were saying all through the 1930s, this is dependent upon what happens in bordering areas. This is dependent upon successive prohibition in surrounding areas. They're talking about China, it's very clear. So this is kind of their opt-out. Well, what they see is their opt-out. The Americans will eventually argue with them whether it is actually something that they can use. And I guess now this is really looking at why. Why did they make this decision at this time after, 30 years of not willing to go along with the American conception? In a matter of months, they come around, not even months, they come around to the view that, yes, we have to go along with what the Americans want. There is a consistent fear of the American drug policy apparatus. These guys, as I was saying about Anslinger, a lot of them are quite, they're moralists, but they're also quite amoral. And they're willing to say and do anything to achieve their ends. Because they see that they see it in almost messianic terms. And the British were worried about these guys. They were saying, these are unscrupulous people. They will say and do anything. They're quite powerful here in Washington. And we don't want them messing up our relationship here in the US. So we're best off playing on the side of caution and not antagonizing these people. There's also this issue that the UK had progressively become more reliant on the US. So 1942, Britain is the prime player in the Grand Alliance. End of 1942, I think it's probably near parity. As you get into 1943, it completely shifts. And by the end of 1943, Britain is almost entirely reliant on the US. So the power dynamic is completely different. In 1942, Britain would have just said no. Anslinger pressed it at the right time, when this kind of change dynamic had just become apparent, and the British realised that they were slightly vulnerable. There was also this broader issue of colonies in the wartime alliance. So this was the one really inflammable area of the Grand Alliance. Churchill threatened to resign at one stage when FDR pushed the idea of decolonising India, and he said, "I've not taken over to pull apart," I can't remember the quote, "but I've not taken over to pull apart the British Empire," essentially. So it was something that the two sides had agreed not to discuss. It was obviously going to be an issue in the post-war era, but they were not discussing it during the alliance. And you saw this very effective propaganda campaign going on in early 1943, where certain British officials, very charismatic British officials, went around Washington and US universities and made the case for why British colonialism wasn't a completely evil thing. And it seemed to be working. It died down, the public hysteria died down. So whereas the Americans prior were saying, "Well, we're not fighting this war to give Britain back its empire," it just kind of went silent. And they were afraid that this issue, which is really kind of symptomatic of what the Americans didn't like about the British Empire, could reignite all that. So they were very conscious of this, that we don't want something like this again messing things up with our Washington alliance. There's also implicit in this a lot is this fear that, well, they're asking for this in areas that US troops would be operating. But it's not yet extended to India. They haven't said, "We want this a blanket ban throughout the empire." And that would have been very difficult to enforce. They just couldn't. There was no way, there was absolutely no way India would enforce this policy or would even accept it. So I think there was a sense, and it's hard to prove by the documents, but it's kind of something that's implicit in a lot of it, that if we don't kind of nip this in the bud now, in a year's time or whatever, they're going to come back to it and they're going to say, "Well, we want this extended all across the empire. We're not going to let you see this continue in India or anywhere else." So I think they thought they'd get ahead of it in that regard. As I already discussed, the power shift of the colonial office to the foreign office during the war, I think that was quite an important factor. And there was, they consistently, they, like when they made the decision, it shifted into this almost giddy, like, okay, how are we going to get the best public relations coup out of this? How are we going to get the press to say how great we are, and we're going to get props in China and America, and it's going to work out so well for us? So they did actually think that they were going to get loads of credit on the international stage. Everyone would say how great Britain was. And the alternative, of course, was the danger that you'd see this massive PR offensive. And Anslinger did very consciously, he said this throughout a lot of meetings, "Well, the press are sniffing around this, and I don't know if some muckraking reporter is going to make this an issue." And, of course, he was somebody who actually had a lot of control of the press. He would slip certain reporters certain stories, and his narrative basically became the US press narrative. So they kind of, there was this whole public relations aspect to it. As I was saying as well with the issue with the Colonial Office and the Foreign Office, the administrative costs of this, you weren't going to feel them initially. So in 1943, you were arguing over administrative costs versus administrative benefits that you didn't feel, and you wouldn't feel for a few years, and might change in the interim period. Whereas the immediate cost, the public relations cost, would be immediate and could affect broader British foreign policy. So I think that the fact that this kind of changed metric, it's not surprising that they said, well, we'll deal with these issues. We know this is going to be problematic when we reoccupy it, but we'll deal with that later. And this, the Dutch, I don't know why the Dutch made their decision. I haven't seen the documentary evidence. I imagine it's probably the same as why the British made the decision, or something similar. And especially, you know, the Dutch government wasn't exactly functioning fully during World War II. But the British said this made it very difficult to resist American proposals. If the Dutch were going to go along with it, we'd essentially become a regional pariah. So we just kind of had to grin and bear. I think these are the broader, I'm coming to the end now, I think these are the broader kind of what if diplomatic history questions. I think there's a certain tendency to look at the system as it is today and see a kind of almost teleological, almost deterministic, it was bound to turn out the way that it did. And I don't think it was. I think that it could have very easily, if they hadn't pushed this issue during the war, if the Americans hadn't, what was essentially smart, somewhat cowboy diplomacy, it mightn't have been resolved. And then what you would have seen is after the war, these short-term exigencies, well, we're taking over war-torn areas, we don't want to deal with the opium issue yet, let's reinstitute the colonies, or let's reinstitute the monopolies, and then let's gradually, in the medium to long-term, phase them out, and that medium to long-term never would have come. So I don't think the system naturally would have disappeared. And if they hadn't, the post-war system would have been very different. Because immediately what you would have seen was the old battle lines would have re-emerged after the war. This was largely solved now, and they could focus more on this kind of... You have these kind of... Sorry, you have... The regime now divides, as I was saying, the broad cleavages. You have manufacturers versus producers, and that's the core cleavage, and it's the friction between those two determines the outcomes after the war. And the manufacturers are much more powerful than the producers. They're, you know, industrialized, advanced nations. They're going to win that battle, and that's why we end up with a kind of contemporary drug control system. So just to look at some of the results, as I was saying, it fundamentally reshaped the international control. Now, I think Dave probably spoke about US hegemony and the role of that in the evolution of the international system. And I think the hegemonic concept is a useful one in many regards. And I think if you're to find where US drug control hegemony began, it's with the end of this issue. In 1943, that's when they really take control. And they've eliminated their most consistent opposition and their most coherent and powerful opposition with the resolution of this. And so then when you see in the post-war world, the drug control system gets incorporated into the United Nations, the US is at the very centre of that, and they're really calling many of the shots, certainly in the first 5 to 10 years. This is completely opposite to the League of Nations system, where the US didn't even recognise the League of Nations, and so it was never really a full, it never really had both feet in the door. As this guy Anslinger, he didn't rest after this. He immediately joined, he took this, he got a lot of credit in America for this, a lot of congressmen. He was hailed as just this strategic genius who had won the major goal of US drug diplomacy for the last 40 years. And he immediately shifts focus and starts saying, right, now we have to push all, before the war ends, we want Iran, we want Afghanistan, all these traditional regime recalcitrants, people or countries that didn't go along with the notion of supply control. We've got to pressure them very quickly so that they're all on site by the time the war ends. Then we can push forward the regime in a coherent front. And so he's less successful with them. But it just shows that it was all part of a broader strategy that he did kind of build on and use. So, what you also, I think, not only did the opposition end, but colonial powers now become adamant supply controllers. You can't institute prohibition in Burma without instituting it in China and all these areas, and so these guys are now advocates for everyone has to buy into this system. If we're prohibiting, everyone has to largely buy in. If this notion is a kind of political science-y notion, again, of pushing the policy window. Instead of the issue of the regime being over, whether quasi-medical or full medical scientific use, that had been decided. So now the window was over levels of control. So they'd completely shifted the debate. Just broader implications is kind of, yeah, this wasn't predetermined. The role of wartime. Virginia Berridge was at our conference last week, which our report that I left has come from, and she was talking about the role of war as an engine in international drug control, and it really was vital. The system never would have taken off without World War I. It might have collapsed eventually without World War II. So it really was vital, and it was the result of an aggressive U.S. diplomacy during this time. Yeah, so I think I'll leave it there.